Thanks very much, Pat. Good afternoon, everybody. We're almost there, almost to the end of the afternoon. It's really an honor for me to be a part of this panel, to be up here with these wonderful colleagues and mentors, and to be able to represent NIEHS and my director, Linda Birnbaum, who sends her regrets that she could not be here. But I am here in her place to talk to you about our institute and our vision for the future of environmental health from an environmental health research perspective. So just about 49 years ago, exactly to the day, there was a spinoff, or a startup, I guess you might say. Maybe it was one of the first startups out of the National Cancer Institute. By congressional mandate, arose a group of scientists who set up in Research Triangle Park to start looking at the health impacts of environmental chemicals. So 1966, November 1st. So a year from now, right in the middle of the next APHA annual meeting, we at NIEHS will be celebrating our 50th anniversary. So this is really a great opportunity to look back a little bit, as we've been doing, and then to look forward and talk to you about our vision for the future. So I thought I would take us back a little bit and it's not completely gratuitous. There is a purpose to this, but I thought it might be fun to look back at the world 50 years ago. I had absolutely no financial interest in giving this talk, quite the opposite. So as we've seen, 50 years ago, this is what some of our rivers look like. This is the Cuyahoga River burning in Cleveland because of massive amounts of flammable petrochemicals and other chemicals back in the 60s. And as Tom mentioned, this was part of the genesis of the Clean Water Act and the Environmental Protection Agency. 50 years ago, or maybe a little bit more, this is what air looked like. This is a picture of Pittsburgh at 11 o'clock, which is really cool. The lights are on. Lights are on in the building. The only problem is that it's 11 a.m. That's what the air looked like in Pittsburgh. You may have seen this picture. Ed Begley Jr. Showed this picture at his great opening talk. This is what the air looked like in Los Angeles 50 years ago. And this is what the people looked like in Los Angeles 50 years ago. People were pretty concerned about these incredibly high levels. They were starting to realize that when you breathe toxic air in Los Angeles, that it was bad for your health. I actually bumped into Ed Begley in the exhibit hall as he was walking out all by himself, and he told me that in his activist teenage days, he would run around the streets of Los Angeles with a gas mask on, looking like these people to try to prove a point. He said he wasn't very popular for that. And 50 years ago, doctors looked like this. So some people realized that breathing in really polluted bad air was bad for you, but people still hadn't quite gotten in their heads that setting things on fire and sticking them into your mouth and putting them into your lungs wasn't a good idea. In fact, back then doctors were prescribing cigarettes, or even a little before, for respiratory ailments. And this is what RTP looked like about 50 years ago. Now, I'd really love to get up here and tell you that what those gentlemen are doing is actually dissecting rats and conducting toxicological experiments. And this is like the birthplace of NIEHS, but it's actually the birthplace of the Research Triangle Institute. But it didn't look like Bethesda, Maryland. And, being down there gives me just an opportunity to say that NIEHS, while it is one of the 27 institutes and centers of the NIH, is different. There are lots of cultural differences for being set apart from NIH. It shares a lot with the NIH. I won't say that it's completely different. But we are the only institute of the NIH that really has a primary public health mission and really focuses on the prevention of disease at more than the treatment and diagnosis of disease. We're also unique in some ways. We, like most of NIH, we have intramural laboratory scientists. We have big grant program, but we also have some real translational components like the National Toxicology Program that really is a collaboration with FDA and NIOSH to do regulatory science. And we have things like the Superfund Research Program and the Worker Training Program and components to us that make us quite an interesting hybrid that bridge, in totality, these things bridge the laboratory to the world of public health in many ways. So this is what we look like now, and the air's a little cleaner than 50 years ago. And I put this up in part to kind of emphasize this transition from the world of 50 years ago. So NIEHS was created, and it's not a coincidence that it started with scientists from the National Cancer Institute. It was created to look at, in an era of concern about very high doses, and in many ways a concern about cancer. And so the history of our institute is kind of a one chemical to some almost, at the start, a limited number of health outcomes. There's a lot of cancer in DNA research. And thinking about chemicals one at a time and in high doses. My theme for today is going to be the transition away from this. So let me talk to you a little bit about this. So while the air has gotten cleaner and while rivers don't catch on fire and we've had a very effective environmental protection agency for many of our issues and the world has gotten a lot cleaner, we've noticed some other problems. We have some other rapid increases in incidence of diseases, whether we're talking about diabetes, autism, we've talked about asthma, other kinds of neurodevelopmental delays, increases that point to environmental causes, and yet the environmental cause isn't quite as clear as cancer from or respiratory disease from air pollution, etc. And so we know that we need to be thinking about a broader array of health outcomes, and also to be thinking about exposures that are more complex and in lower doses. We also realize, starting perhaps with the diethyl sylvestrol and the clear cell cancer that arise in the daughters and of the women that took that disease, that medicine, that there is a phenomenon of developmental impacts of environmental chemicals. That this idea that you go out on a day of air pollution and something happens to you that day is not the way a lot of things happen in environmental health. And we've become much more attuned to the idea of windows of susceptibility, of the critical periods starting prenatally and preconception even, and then carrying through fetal development and into early years. And so we have this broad conceptual shift in the environmental health sciences from this idea of high doses to low doses, from the idea of damage to DNA and damage to proteins to more subtle kinds of disruption, and to this idea of windows of susceptibility. So this is kind of the 1970s version of environmental health, and we talk about this continuum from an exposure to disease from left to right. And this worked well. This is the way we thought about the research paradigm, trying to fill in these boxes. But what's happened in the last 20 years is things have gotten a lot more complex, right? We started, because of the ability to sequence DNA, we started realizing, well, everybody's a little bit different in their DNA, and that these differences that people are born with may be responsible for some of the differences we see in susceptibility. So there's a lot of looking at people's DNA. And then we exploded with the genomic revolution. We exploded our ability to look at all different aspects of gene expression. And so we started thinking that we could get much more fundamental information on mechanisms and understand exactly what exposure is linked with what outcome, if we can just figure out what the gene product is. And so we started looking in more detail at gene expression. And then we realized that, well, we're focusing all this stuff on genes, but that 90% of our DNA that we thought was junk is actually intimately responsible for coding it. And in fact, that these marks that get made on the non-coding DNA, the whole field called epigenetics, where we put methyl groups on or we otherwise alter the DNA or the chromosome molecule, is where a lot of the action may be going on in environmental health. And a lot of the action may be going on in these developmental impacts. That this is one way that you get this acquired change to your gene expression, and it can actually be transmitted intergenerationally. So the picture gets a lot more complex. Then we realized with the genomic revolution that all of those microbes that live in our gut are having this huge impact on us, and of course we take antibiotics and we inhale arsenic or we ingest arsenic, that there's this very important relationship between the microbiome. So things get complicated very quickly, and this is the complex world in which we're living and in which NIEHS is now trying to frame its advanced science. And then that's just a little sensor, which is my symbol for exposure technologies, our ability to measure things at massive numbers of things in very small quantities of sample has exploded. And so we're able to get away from just looking at, you know, single exposures and look at exposure-wide and this whole concept of the exposome. You know, we put another OME on it because we've fallen in love with that in the last couple of decades. But this idea that we can look comprehensively over numerous categories of exposures and even try to integrate over time is another area that's developed. So these are my themes for talking about the future, this high dose to low dose, the life course approach, and this ability, because of the explosion in the genomic technologies, to be able to get at the fundamental mechanisms of some of these increasing diseases of various types. So when I asked Dr. Birnbaum, what should I really be telling people about the vision for the future, her answer was, John, you know, we just did a strategic plan, so I'm sorry to do another strategic plan, and I'm not going to talk about the strategic plan, but I am going to use our strategic plan, which is 2012 to 2017, as a frame for just talking about and some of the examples, just give a little more flesh to this theme, these themes, and also to describe the ways in which our institute is really trying to interact with the broader world of public health beyond just conducting kind of cool research with all of this new technology. So we have six themes, which I'm going to go over, which are the things in the middle of that spiraling circle, and I'm going to go through them in some detail. There's a reason why there's that spiral. It's very hard to talk about. You know, the problem with strategic plans is you're trying to kind of separate things, and we do take a very integrated approach to this, and our projects take, you know, will integrate many of these different fundamental themes, but I'll use them as a framework for talking about them. At the top, those blue arrows talk about some of the... So in the middle, those are the things that's the content. That's the what of what we're trying to do. The blue arrows are a little bit of the how, and I'm not going to say very much about this, but we are focusing on broader collaborative and integrative approaches both within the Institute, across disciplines, and across agencies. And also having this explosion in information requires... an evolution of knowledge management, and that's a very important theme for us. That's all I'm going to say about that. So fundamental research is what the biomedical institute like the NIEHS, any part of NIH, prides itself in. Some of the things that we are focusing on are ways of capturing these novel technologies. We have a big project on high-throughput screening to help on the regulatory side, the ability to use robotics and in vitro techniques to screen chemicals in a much larger way. I mentioned that we are linking to the explosion in the microbiome, have many projects related to that. We're doing interesting work to try to get a better handle on susceptibility. Traditional toxicology will take a group of 10 inbred mice and consider that representative of humans. We've gotten past that and have done some innovative work to deliberately outbreed mice but standardize them so that there's reproducibility, but we are capturing broader genetic variation in our laboratory work, and even getting down to the using new techniques to simulate tissues, organs, and being able to simulate a lot of different genetic susceptibility issues on a chip in an in vitro situation. One important thing that I think relates a lot to concerns in the environmental justice community and the public health community in general is the issue of cumulative stress. We talk about this a lot. We say that the people who are exposed to the chemicals the most are also exposed to nutritional deprivation. They're also exposed to violence, domestic stress, a lot of discrimination, poverty, a lot of psychosocial stress. But we really have lacked basic biological approaches to that. That's starting to change with these new technologies. And so a lot of the work that we're doing is starting to explore interactions between chemical exposures and nutritional issues, chemical exposures and psychosocial stressors. It's nascent, but I think this is one area that we share as a really important interest. On exposure research, I'm not going to say a whole lot about this. We have a new branch that we've created to take advantage of some of these new technologies. We're doing everything from supporting small business innovation grants to create really cool new sensors that people can wear on their wrists, like you see pictured there, to supporting these kind of exposure-wide association studies. You know, everybody else in NIH does GWAS, genome-wide association studies. We're doing EWAS, where we're trying to see what kind of exposures link together and then are associated with outcomes. We are making a major investment in something called the Children's Health Exposure Analysis Resource with funds left over from the Children's Health Study. This is creating this is kind of an infrastructure project to complement all of the work that goes on at the NCEH and the National Health Laboratories there to help with repositories, knowledge management, and cohort, looking at our cohorts and creating large archive samples, adding more environmental sampling to some of the existing children's cohorts. Translational science for NIEHS is real different from translational science for the rest of the NIH. For everybody else, it's bench to bedside. It's going from a test tube to a drug, basically. For us, I use the term bench to curbside. It could be bench to bench side in a regulatory court of law. It could be all kinds of new places, but it's basically providing information to support regulatory and often personal decision making. And we do a lot of work that is in this translational realm. One of the new projects going on is that the National Toxicology Program has really developed the methods for systematic review to be able to take a lot of different kinds of studies, epi, tox, in vitro, animal studies, and how do you put that together to be able to do mostly hazard identification in a regulatory setting. So that's one thing that the Institute's doing to try to step that up, both domestically and internationally. We have an interesting program called the Disaster Research Response, which is addressing this gap that occurs. So we know there's a lot of hazardous waste out there. We know that people get exposed to it when there are disasters like Katrina and Sandy. But we have never had the ability to really study that in real time. So that's part of the genesis of this, to create pre-approved research protocols, to develop a network, to provide resources so that in the context of spills, extreme weather events, et cetera, there's an ability to actually gather data and really get a better handle on all of the different health impacts associated with that. Our fourth theme is health disparities in global environmental health. There are a lot of activities that go on in different places associated with this. Our partnerships in environmental public health is one important piece of this. This is the collection of our core centers that do community outreach and are very much in touch with the community groups where those environmental health centers are. As a group, our partners both create a lot of and share a lot of important materials for communities, but we're also pulling together the environmental justice community and community groups in a number of very powerful ways around environmental health issues, and in conjunction with our worker training program on climate change and climate justice issues as well. Global climate change falls under this theme of global environmental health, and so the activities that we've been doing, the first targeted funding program that was a series of exploratory grants, which is closed now, was under this theme, and also our current Climate Change and Environmental Exposures Data Challenge, which is out now. Look on our website, look at the Federal Register. It closes December 4th, our activities in this realm. NIEHS has been designated as a collaborating center of WHO, and I direct that collaborating center and coordinate all of our activities on global environmental health and work on the translation of that into a global context with the WHO. I know there's a lot of stuff going on, and I'm going to just let you read this, and I'm just going to say that there's often a lot of questions and a lack of awareness of the various ways that students and others can engage with NIEHS. It's not just about being a postdoc in our intramural research labs or getting research funding for your doctoral degree. We have a lot of programs for high school students, for medical students, for students at historically African-American colleges, many programs to reach out and give people an exposure to environmental health. And training and capacity building is also one of the core activities of our collaborating center. I also just want to let people know about our worker training program. This is a unique program that has trained 2.7 million individuals in this country. It's a huge network of academic centers in partnership with a lot of unions. And when we think about public health, when we think about environmental health literacy in disadvantaged communities, it is the people who do hazardous waste work. That's often people at the lower end of the labor scale. Giving them training on self-protection, on industrial hygiene, on environmental exposures is actually a very, very powerful way of getting, you know, to a group that might otherwise not get good training on environmental health issues. So a very powerful piece of our institute. And then lastly, on communications and engagement, this is an area where the institute is starting to fund more research on communication itself. So it's not just about doing it, but actually doing some empirical testing of methods. Our flagship journal, Environmental Health Perspectives, is not only a high-impact journal, it has a lot of various translational components. If you go on the website, there's curriculum associated with it. We have the news features, which are wonderful summaries of current events. And EHP is also translated into Chinese and goes out to thousands of people in China to do a global awareness raising as well. And then, of course, we have our partners group. So those of you who are in NGOs and would like to affiliate with NIEHS, we have an ongoing outreach with them. This is my iPad moment, if anybody wants to just take pictures of that. Those are all the URLs for the various ways. We have numerous newsletters that go out to reach specific communities. Our breast cancer program has a newsletter. The Global Environmental Health Program has a newsletter. Worker training, partnerships in environmental public health. All of these reach our targeted stakeholders. So in terms of broad overarching themes, again, this is a slide that I did take from Dr. Birnbaum. This is part of the vision of looking ahead for us. There is a lot of work, a lot stronger collaboration with our sister institutes through the National Toxicology Program and just through direct interactions. We're looking at more complex diseases and looking at the fundamental mechanisms of them and looking in a more complex way at cumulative stresses and exposure through the life course. And we're really working on improving the integration across different kinds of environmental science and the translation and communication of that science. So thank you for the attention and at this late hour of the day, and I look forward to our discussion.
So I just want to thank our speakers for having left some time so that we can have some questions and discussions, and I'm going to ask the first question, actually. So I thought it might be interesting, given that, as I said at the beginning, that I think each of the three of them rarely has an opportunity to address a group like this that is, you know, well tired at the end of the third day of the conference. Nonetheless, it's among some of the strongest supporters for what the three of them are doing. And given that, you know, to ask them, okay, what can we do to help them, you know, with this work? What would they like from all of us? They're obviously giving a tremendous amount every day in the jobs that they're doing. But, you know, what do you guys need from us? And maybe starting with you, Tom.
Oh, how much time do you
have? Long time.
So they may affect the bottom line for people. They do affect jobs. If you are going to take on climate, if you're going to take on carbon, it's going to affect people. It's going to affect utility bills. It's going to affect communities. It's going to bring change. And change is tough. And we, as a public health community, unfortunately, are organized. And we think about our compartments, but we have to think about the system. Really the front lines of environmental protection, that start the conversation now.
Yes.
So I'd like to just add a little bit to what Tom just said. So I think one of the biggest ways we can all work together is we need to be ambassadors for environmental health. You know, how many times I've talked to people and they say, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm an environmental health. They always say, what's that? There's not a clear understanding, appreciation of what we bring to the country, what we do to get people's health amongst the broader constituency. And until that understanding is there, I think the natural support that would swell up from that isn't going to be there. So we need to help think about how we sell what we do, why we do it, and how we help the world. And I think that's something we can all participate in. And so every opportunity we get to blog, to write letters, to the newspapers, to participate in a broader discussion about the importance of environmental health across the board. And I'm talking about the environment at large. You know, I think we need to do that, and we need to get society to appreciate who we are, what we do, why it's important.
And if I can just reflect on something, somebody I know who works in your agency who was present when you first learned about the Camp Lejeune problem. And this particular staff person was both amazed and very, very excited about the fact that he recognized the humanity of the people who were affected by this and your role as a federal official in addressing a situation that was obviously very difficult. And I guess they were surprised because you were scientists and they didn't expect that. And but I thank you for that. I think it's very important that that is a part. It's a huge part of what you all are doing. You're a human. Yes, you are. And thank you for that.
NIEHS is a little bit different from CDC and EPA in terms of the type of cultural issues that we have. We have the culture of NIH is very strong. Its primary research is not surrounded by enemies to the same degree. NIH is one of the more popular components of the biomedical world from a political standpoint. And so the needs are a little bit different in some ways. And you know, almost in the same way that we sometimes don't want to talk about climate change as calling it climate change, but talk about disasters and heat waves because people understand that, get that, and know that that's important. Sometimes, as the 27th or one of 27 institutes with environmental health in the name, if we say, well, it's all we have to tell you what environmental health is, they will say, well, that's NIEHS. And that's a way of saying, we care about that, go over there, marginalize. So I think one of our challenges is to mainstream, just like we have to mainstream climate change, we have to mainstream environmental health. We have to point out to people that despite the massive investment in shipping vaccines and treatments and drugs, that we still are the 20th ranked developing country in the world, that there's something missing in this. And it is the environment writ large. It's not just chemicals in the environment. It's not just environmental regulation. It is a broader concept of the environment, including psychosocial stress, including the built environment, including ecosystems, et cetera. And so having an advocacy community to the mainstream biomedical research world that conveys that, I think, is a very important thing to community to do.
John, your agenda.
So
I'll repeat the question.
So I remember my first day in my MPH. I got the typical story about the bodies floating in the river and public health trying to go upstream to see what's pushing them in. And I heard your talking about the broader context of things, that there's much more interdependence between ecosystems and everything that becomes a system. And I'm wondering how far upstream are you able to get to really get to the root causes of some of these issues. For example, USDA and the U.S. Farm Bill and its relationship with corn-based ethanol and what happens to our food and how unsafe that is in front of the community, and the Department of Energy. So I'm wondering, in this work in a systems-based approach, are you engaging as far upstream as you need to engage to some of the big issues?
So the question is about how far upstream can we go? The classic example of seeing the bodies floating down the stream and we need environmental help about trying to figure out how they got
media has to somewhat narrow focus on that. It touches everything from water use, from the water requirements of the agricultural community, to the disposal, to seismic activity, to global climate change and carbon, to energy prices that we all like. We're kind of happy we can fill the tank for a little less right now, right? Like secretly, even environmentalists. $75 to fill up. Now it's like 20. I'm not going to advocate for one technology over another. I'm from EPA. But bringing the science to that, you're absolutely right. It touches every agency. There's lots of things that go into that, from the Department of Energy to the Department of Labor to the Bureau of Land Management to USGS. And there are coordinating ways to do that. We can do that better. But we have to understand that our actions in public health have a broad reach, and it's this systems approach that's going to enable us to do that better. When we run amok is when we don't have those conversations up front. And we think about things in the agricultural community without thinking downstream to algal blooms, to nitrates, and to well contamination. So I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic about everything. But I have to tell you, being in this job right now and seeing how things work across agencies, we can do this. We can think across the agency. We will not always win, but we will be at the table, and public health is there, and it's an important part.
So, with respect to National Center for Environmental Health, we don't look upstream that far at all. I'm sorry to say that. We nibble on some stuff. So in the tobacco arena, where we work with the FDA on tobacco products regulation, we might deal with some farming issues around industrial agriculture exposures. But we're not trying to push those broader policies. That's just not part of our portfolio.
I answer that from two perspectives. First, from an NIEHS-only perspective, again, we're different. We're a biomedical research institution, and our culture is investigator-initiated research. And so, any issue that an investigator deems as worthy, can go up the chain and start working on developing that basic science. And in fact, we have for a lot of issues, whether it's oceans and human health, a lot of pesticide work comes from the NIEHS, farm worker health, and so on and so on. So, we certainly provide a venue to develop that science. We're a research institute. We don't engage in that policy. But wearing the hat of, just a comment, wearing the hat of, I started off showing pictures of RTP, but most people know that I'm not an RTP, I'm in Bethesda. Pat's hanging out around the Washington metro area as well, and has been there, but NCEH is located in Atlanta. There's not a core body of environmental health expertise in Washington. And so within the Department of Health and Human Services, in the Department of Health and Human Services, there wasn't a period between within that, not in Washington, within the Department of Health and Human Services, it's not that there's not an entity that coordinates environment and environmental health issues. So there is, the theme of this meeting is health and all policy. This is the theme of the Department of Health and Human Services. But, I think that there is a need to help the Health Department of Health and Human Services understand its role in that way. Right now, it doesn't happen. But I think that there is an opportunity. There are models from the states of how a health department can get involved and solve complex wicked problems as part of the team. And so, something to aspire for, and I think this group can help with that.
So, we have another question that I just wanted to make a comment. I mean, arguably, the environmental health research of the year that saved the most lives was the guy who discovered the fraudulent programming of the VW diesel engines, which turns out to be a practice that many auto companies probably have been doing. And especially in Europe, there's probably been a lot of deaths from particulate matter exposures and other exposures because of that kind of fraud. And that wasn't even while it's sponsored by any of these agencies, I'm not really sure who sponsored it. It was somebody who doesn't even look like, an engineer, doesn't even look like an environmental health person. Did you sponsor it?
There's a lot of folks that contributed to that, but EPA is certainly in the leadership role right now and understand the extent.
Well, the extent of it turned out to be enormous. We haven't even sense of how many people have been killed because of it. I think it's, if you look at CDC, if this were an infection, it would be all over the CDC agenda. This is, it's an amazing public health disaster.
It's true, and if it were an ignition switch, where there was some very high visibility catastrophes,
an explosion, exploding cars.
But affecting people with chronic disease, that may be a little bit invisible, has such a profound impact. So you're right.
Actually affecting each and every one of us. But we have a question here.
Incentives spend a lot of time and a lot of man hours and woman hours in interviews.
to do that, if one of them comes forth and says, I'm coordinating us, then that's a little bit, well, you start to get these turf issues among the agencies. It's important that the White House assume that role, and it hasn't always steadily done so. And we're successful, like with the Global Climate Change Research Program, it's because there is a constituency that steadily supports that, steadily expects that. And honestly, you know, our public health constituency isn't always that constant, you know, in terms of exerting that kind of support. And so, you know, just a commentary that perhaps we all need to be more watchful and persistent, and, you know, whoever's in the White House have the expectation that that coordination is going to occur. I think we may be at the end of our session, but I think that we also have three speakers up here who may be willing to